British historian Andrew Roberts, in the introduction to his most recent book called The Last King of America, a 757-page opus on King George III, says the following. Quote from Mr. Roberts, "The portrait of a heartless, absolute sovereign is repeated almost every single day in America's print and online media. Even two centuries after his death, hardly a day passes in the United States without some reference to George III, where he is still held up as an equal opportunities hate figure, an archetypal bogeyman attacked in the same measure by Democrats and Republicans alike." Andrew Roberts, over the past 30 years, has also written major histories about Napoleon, Churchill, and World War II. Andrew Roberts, can you tell me, from your perspective, what the difference is between an American and a Brit?
What an extraordinary question. Well, I suppose the key one is that we're a monarchy and you're a republic. That's the one I go for first. But otherwise, I like to concentrate on the things that we have in common, our law and our literature and our language and so on.
But what is, you know, you've spoken in front of many American audiences and many British audiences. Do you sense a difference in the interest that they show and what they're interested in?
Well, you tend to be more polite. But maybe it's because I'm a Brit and therefore in front of British audiences, people are a bit more sort of harsh and tough. But the people, especially who turn up to literary events in America, tend to be the most incredibly polite people in the world. So I do notice that very much.
When you came to the United States to do your tour on the book on King George III, how did you compare the audience's interest in him compared to the other books you've done, Napoleon and Winston Churchill?
Well, I think the obvious difference, of course, is that the George III was your last king. And so, in a sense, the interest was about the revolution and how the revolution took place and whether or not George III was a tyrant and so on. Whereas with Napoleon and with Churchill, the emphasis is very much on them, as opposed to anything they might have interacted with America over.
Well, those three men that you've written a lot about, which one did you spend the most time getting ready for the book?
Well, Napoleon took me 6 years to research and write, and Churchill took 4 years, and George III took three. But in fact, in a sense, of course, I've been writing about Churchill all my life, for the last 30 years, certainly. I've been, I think I've published 5 books with his name in the title or the subtitle. So I suppose it would have to be him.
The last and only time you and I have talked was in London in 2002. And one of the things, when I went back and watched it, I had forgotten about that. You said you were on your way to writing an authorized biography of Henry Kissinger. Why did you not do that?
Well, it was quite a difficult decision, that actually. Once I discovered that he had deposited 30 tons of papers at the Library of Congress, I recognized that it would require an enormous amount more commitment than I could give. It would require a lot of research assistance that would be expensive. It would require me to live in America permanently. I had not signed any contract or anything like that. And then the great news came that my great friend Neil Ferguson was going to be able to make that commitment, make both of those commitments. And so he's taken it on. But as you say, that was 20 years ago, and Neil has published volume one of the book. So it really was an extraordinary commitment to undertake. I should have thought it through a bit more impressively at the time, frankly.
In one of your events that I watched on either C-SPAN or YouTube, you said that your next book, at least you implied that your next book would be on Disraeli. Is that your plan?
Yes, very much. In fact, this morning I was working on that, on getting a timeline together of Disraeli's life and death. So it's all underway.
Why did you pick him?
Well, he's an enormous figure. I'm not sure how well known he is in America, but he certainly is a big figure in Britain. He was, I think, the Prime Minister with the most interesting and exciting backstory, apart from possibly Winston Churchill himself. He was Jewish, of course, a complete outsider when it came to the Victorian world. He was never went to public school or Oxford, and so somehow through his wit and his genius, really, and his intellect, he managed to become Prime Minister at a time of massive anti-Semitism across the certainly the upper classes in Britain and Victorian England. And then he went on to be a very successful Prime Minister. So I think it's and at the time, of course, Britain was the most powerful empire in the world. So it was a real sort of story of a complete outsider becoming essentially the most powerful man in the world.
To put all these people in perspective, just mention one more thing about Disraeli. Why would Richard Nixon have admired him?
Well, I've read Nixon on Disraeli. I think Nixon was being a little bit solipsistic here in that he was seeing himself as an outsider. You know, having grown up, not exactly in poverty, but not well off in California, he managed to get to become the most powerful man in the world as well. So I wonder whether or not he might have been thinking about Richard Nixon as much as about Benjamin Disraeli.
In your book on King George III, you have a footnote in the conclusion chapter from a speech from Winston Churchill in 1919. I'll read what he said and then ask you to break it down for us. George Washington, this was on George Washington's birthday, by the way. George Washington was an English gentleman who fought against a German king and defended his country by the aid of men of British blood against a very considerable number of Hessian and Hanoverian mercenaries. Break it all down for us.
Classic. This is classic Churchill. Yes, well, first of all, George III was not a German king. He was very much an English king. English was his first language. He was the first king of England for about 150 years to have been born and bred and educated in Britain, and was very proud of it and was popular for it, in fact. And secondly, although there were a large number of German, they weren't mercenaries, they were auxiliaries, in fact. There's a sort of etymological difference between them, but nonetheless, they made up about quarter to one third of the British army. So I don't think that, I think in that fantastically patriotic speech that he's making, which he made in the Criterion restaurant in Piccadilly in 1919, as you say, I think he was trying to flatter his American interlocutors more than to actually go for historical truth.
You talk, when you give us the background on this particular book on the king, about your access to the Georgian papers. Explain what those are, and then when did you get access?
Yes, they are. It's called the Georgian Papers Program, and it's a wonderful collaboration between the Royal Archives and King's College London, where I'm a visiting fellow. And what essentially happened in 2015 is that the Queen put 200,000 pages of the Georgian kings, the Hanoverian kings, including, in fact, William the Fourth, online. And so they've been extremely well curated, and they're well documented, and they're well footnoted, and so on. And so when the lockdown happened, and I was in the middle of working at the Royal Archives, and it closed for 18 months, it could have just sort of wrecked the book. But instead, because of this, I was able to read his papers and diaries and memoranda and correspondence and so on online.
So when did you have a couple of those aha moments?
Well, I got one very early on, actually, which was pleasing, because you always want to have a great aha moment when you start, because obviously it sort of gives you a great fillip. And I was working on his essays that he wrote when he was Prince of Wales in the 1750s. And he wrote this. Can I just quote two sentences? This is what I found him writing. What shall we say for European traffic in black slaves? The very reasons urged for it will be perhaps sufficient to make us hold such practice in execration. For an inhuman custom, wantonly practiced by the most enlightened, polite nations in the world, there is no occasion to answer them, for they stand self-condemned. So you have here a Prince of Wales in the 1750s who is clearly opposed to slavery. He never bought or sold a slave in his life. He never invested in any of the companies that did that. And he eventually signed the legislation that abolished the slave trade. And yet he's been held for 200 years as being on a much lower sort of moral plane than the signatories of the Declaration of Independence, for example. There were 56 of them, 42 of them owned slaves at some stage in their lives. So I think that was a worthwhile aha moment. And in fact, that document, which I've also used as an illustration in my book, has just been published in full in the Times Literary Supplement.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
I'm going to quote you from the Declaration of Independence, because you have a whole chapter on this. And just before Thomas Jefferson and his committee get into accusations against King George III, they wrote, "The history of the present King of Great Britain is a history of repeated injuries and usurpations, all having in direct object the establishment of an absolute tyranny over these states." Your reaction to that?
Completely untrue. It's a beautiful document, the Declaration of Independence. Those opening two paragraphs are as fine a piece of English as can be found, including with Shakespeare and the authorized version of the Bible. It makes you proud to be a human, some of the arguments put forward in the Declaration. Utterly sublime prose. But as you say, then there's this second section which attempts to make George III out to be unfit to be the ruler of a free people, and plotting an absolute tyranny and so on, which is absolutely rubbish. There are 28 charges, only two of which hold any water whatsoever in the Declaration. But those two, the 17th, which is about taxation, and the 22nd, which is about Parliament's veto right over American legislation, in and of themselves justify the American Revolution. You see, America was ready and ripe for revolution. It was right to have an independent America in the 1770s. But that doesn't turn George III into a tyrant, which he was not.
So your book on Napoleon, your book on Winston Churchill, and now your book on this king, I want to ask you some questions about all three of them. First, what role did religion play in each of their lives?
Well, in George III, a great deal. He was a practicing Anglican. He was very interested in theology and in the church. He was pious in the right sense of the word, and the direct sort of connection to the Almighty was something that he believed he had all his life. Churchill, not so much. Churchill believed that he was not a Christian in the sense that he didn't believe that Jesus was the Son of God, but he did believe that Jesus had handed down the finest system of ethics and morals that the world had ever seen. And he did believe in an Almighty, although when you look into it quite carefully, the primary duty of the Almighty was to take care of Winston Churchill, frankly. With Napoleon, it's a little bit more complicated in that he never said he wasn't a believer, but he was much more a sort of follower of Voltaire and Rousseau and their free thinking philosophy. He had a very strange relationship with the Catholic Church in that he did allow it to take over its churches again after the Revolution, and he set up the church again. But then he arrested and imprisoned and kidnapped the Pope. So, all three of them have very different stances with regard to religion.
In one of your talks, you talked about who is allowed to be called great. And you named Peter the Great, Frederick the Great, Catherine the Great, and Alfred the Great. Why wouldn't it be King George the Great, Napoleon the Great, Winston Churchill the Great?
Well, I do call my book Napoleon the Great in England, in fact. And he was called Napoleon Le Grand in some French biographies, especially the ones during his lifetime, obviously. So I think he does deserve the title the Great. Churchill, it's usually the word the Great is usually attached to monarchs and to heads of state, which Churchill never was. And George III can't be, unfortunately, because although, as I say, he wasn't a tyrant, he was king at the time of the greatest catastrophe to overcome my country, between really the loss of the Angevin lands in the 15th century and the fall of France in 1940. So we can't really call him George the Great.
Assassination attempts. The three men, how many?
Lots. Not any on Winston Churchill, extraordinarily, unless you add you take into account the one where he was almost pushed under a train by a suffragette in Bristol in, I think, 1911. But there were many on Napoleon, one which he very narrowly missed, which was when a cart was blown up as his carriage taking him to the opera, and that killed about 20 people, but not him. And then, of course, with George III, he survived 6 assassination attempts, all from people with mental imbalances rather than for political reasons. And he had he showed tremendous calmness and sang-froid under pressure. And actually, on one occasion, when somebody shot him at the beginning of an opera, he went to sleep at the interval.
How did they attempt to assassinate him, in what way?
Well, as I say, one chap tried to stab him at the opera. Somebody else tried to knife him as he was taking a lady called Margaret Nicholson, who he took a petition from, and as he put out his hand, she then took out a knife and stuck it in him, but not very far. There was an attempt to blow him up as his carriage went down the Mall, just got to the Admiralty. They wanted to try and take over a cannon, which turned out to be a ceremonial cannon, and therefore not one that actually worked. And there was also a chap who stayed in St. James's Park until 1 o'clock one morning, and his sedan chair was being brought back by beefeaters to Buckingham Palace, and he didn't put enough gunpowder in the priming pan of his pistol.
You said that Winston Churchill was stabbed by a penknife at a young age. What was that story?
Well, that wasn't an assassination attempt. That was he was 10 years old, and he was having a row with a lad at his prep school, who as you say, stuck a penknife in him. But I don't think that counts as an assassination attempt. There are lots of other times that Churchill nearly died before he became prime minister. He was involved in 3 car crashes, 2 plane crashes. He nearly drowned in Lake Geneva. He nearly was burnt to death in a house fire. He was run over, of course, on 77th Street and 5th Avenue in New York by a car that very nearly killed him. And then, of course, he had a few medical illnesses as well. And he took part in the last great cavalry charge of the British Empire. He escaped from a prisoner of war camp. Under any of these circumstances, he could easily have died.
As long as we're on him at the moment, how did his mother die?
She had to have her leg amputated. I can't remember what the reason for it was, but it went badly off. And she'd had a fall downstairs, and she in some way affected her leg. It was amputated, and then it went wrong, and she died of an embolism.
You wrote
very young, tragically young.
You in some of your other books, and I guess are you using the word the number 19 books at the moment that you've written?
I think if you count the 3 that are just e-books, you know, that you can only get on Kindle, then it's 19. But otherwise, 16 hardbacks.
What about the health of these 3 men? And you can throw in there also, because I was starting to ask you about Hitler, who you've written a lot about also. When you think about health and the people you've written about, what's the backstory?
Well, there are lots of them. Of course, since we're on Churchill had 4 bouts of pneumonia during the Second World War, and 2 of them could have killed him. With regard to otherwise, he lived to be 90. So he was a great sportsman in his youth, and he tended to keep fit until at least he was fighting the Second World War. Even then, people would say he would bound up stairs and keep all of his much younger staff very busy. The health of George III, of course, ties up with his what's called the King's Malady, which was for many years, for the last 50 years, everyone thought it was a disease called porphyria, which it wasn't. That's the result of some misdiagnosis as a result of bad, the wrong symptoms being given to doctors back in the 1960s. In fact, he had bipolar disorder affective type 1, a form of manic depression. But his physical health, other than his mental attacks, were fantastic. I mean, he would ride every day. He enjoyed long walks. He never ate or drank to excess, and so he was pretty fit. And then, of course, Napoleon. You have a man who goes to fat big time in from about 1811 onwards, and by the time he died in May 1821, he'd been suffering from cancer for 4 years, which his entire family had pretty much. It's a pretty sad story, really, as far as his health is concerned.
What about their children? You point out in the book that King George III had 15 children. You say, though, that they were dreadful.
No, not all of them. Some of them were. His eldest son, George IV, Prince of Wales, later the Prince Regent, was a terrible human being, frankly. I could find in the 3 years that I wrote and researched this book not a single moment of a sort of lightness from him. He was a despicable character in many, many ways. But George loved his children, and he was, apart from his eldest son, and he was a very good father to them, and sweet and good-natured, and played with them when they were young and so on. And some of them died tragically early. There were 2 that died when they were 8, and one who was at 18, I think. And it was heartbreaking for him, because he did love them.
What about Napoleon and his kids?
Well, there was only one legitimate one, the King of Rome, who, after the Battle of Waterloo, was wrenched away from him and taken to live in Vienna, and he never saw him again for the last 6 years of his life, which was heartbreaking for Napoleon as well. He had some illegitimate children, and they had a one had a very became an alcoholic and had a had a pretty disastrous life. But another one became the foreign minister of France, in fact, in a future regime.
Winston Churchill and his children, including Randolph.
Again, well, Randolph took to drinks very sadly. He had a good mind and occasionally a brilliant orator, and a pretty good journalist as well, actually. But unfortunately, he just couldn't take having such a famous father as Winston Churchill, even though Winston Churchill had had a tremendously famous father in Lord Randolph Churchill, who was Chancellor of the Exchequer. So that was not a happy relationship. He also had three daughters, one of whom I knew very well, Mary, Lady Soames, who turned out extraordinarily well and was a great woman. Everybody loved Mary. But unfortunately, the other two sisters, Diana and Sarah, had their own demons, and their stories aren't happy ones either, overall.
Cut one of your talks when you were talking about Hitler, and you at one point said you're asked why did he lose the war, and you say because he was a fanatical, unregenerate Nazi. What does that mean?
Well, it meant that he put his Nazism, his political theories, before the grand strategy of winning the war. He would take decisions because of politics, rather than because of what was in the country's best interests or the Wehrmacht's best interests. Classic examples, of course, being the decision to declare war on America, a uninvadable country that was far more powerful industrially and economically than Germany could ever be, and also declaring invading Russia, which he wanted to do in order to wipe out the Jews, to have a final reckoning with the Bolsheviks, and to grab Lebensraum, living space, for the Aryan, you know, master race. And all of those three reasons were driven by his hateful Nazi ideology and nothing to do with his chances of actually defeating Russia. He attacked at the wrong time and in so many ways just made mistake after mistake, primarily because he was a true believer in what he was spouting in his racist rhetoric.
As you know, you're often asked how you do what you do, and you point out that you have a series of things that you do, including what you're doing right now with this Disraeli book, creating a timeline. What will play out from here as you write the next book? How do you do it? How many years will you research? And then how will you write?
It will be 4 years. I will spend the first one creating, as you say, a timeline. So I want to know exactly where he was, what he was doing, what he was saying, what he was writing, pretty much every week of his life, sometimes every day. And then after that, I'll by that stage have also built up over the following year a series of notes in files about different aspects of his life, his private life, his Jewishness, his early political opinions. I'll have read in the third year all 13 of his novels and see the extent to which he was using his novels to sort of project a sense of self, and also his political novels and the extent to which he was able to do the things that he mapped out in his political novels. And then, of course, in the last 6 months or so, I'll sit down and write it.
You've often talked about in your Churchill book that it took 100 days to write it, and you write 5,000 words a day. Will you do the exact same thing with the Disraeli book?
No, I think I'll take 200 days, actually, or 180 days or so. I don't want it to be quite such a fevered slog at the end. Plus, it's not going to be as long as Churchill either. So I ought to be able to pare that down to about 3,000 words a day.
One of the things I heard you talk about once was you didn't say much about this, and I want to ask you to tell us more. You went to St. Helena for some reason. Explain why and how did you get there?
Well, it's where Napoleon died in 1821. So I very much, it's where he spent his exile for the last 6 years of his life. So I very much wanted to go there. The only drawback is that you could only get there in those days. They didn't have the runway that exists today. And so you had to go by the post office steamer, as it were. It's a sort of a boat that goes out. It takes 6 days to get from Cape Town to St. Helena. And, it was quite it's an extraordinary trip, actually, because you're going there along in the Atlantic, and for 6 days you don't see a bird, you don't see a fish, you don't see a plane, nothing. It's just sky and sea. It's the most extraordinary thing, really.
Did you go by yourself?
No, I took a BBC TV camera crew with me because we were making a documentary about Napoleon. So that was much more fun. They were great guys, and we had a good fun trip. But I think it would have been a bit soul destroying being entirely on your own. There were some other nice people on the boat, I hasten to add. Usually bird watchers, because St. Helena has got an indigenous bird that doesn't live anywhere else. It's an island 8 miles by 10 miles wide, and it's the second most remote inhabited island in the world. And so there are 1,000 people on it who've never left the island, which is the most extraordinary thought when you think about it. They were all very nice to me, but I was happy after however many days it was, 4 days or so, to get back to England.
I would ask two questions. Was it worth the trip, and what did you find once you got there?
Oh, it was certainly worth the trip. Yes, absolutely, because you get the sense. First of all, his house, which has been built and rebuilt and rebuilt because termites destroyed it after he died. But it's been rebuilt in exactly the same way as it was before. And his garden is in the same. He spent a lot of time gardening, and his garden is in the same way it was before. The French government take care of it, and it's a piece of France, in fact, legally. And it is hugely sort of redolent of him. And you can go into the room in which he died and walk up the steps he walked up and so on. It's a powerful thing, partly, I suppose, because of its very remoteness. You know, he'd lost the Battle of Waterloo, and we didn't want him to escape again like he escaped from Elba in 1815. So we stuck him on this absolutely incredibly tiny remote island in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, and sure enough he wasn't able to escape from that.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
A lot of people ask you how you write, including me, but I rarely heard anybody ask you how you read.
I'm not the omnivorous reader that that some people are, in fact. I can only really read one book at a time. I can't read three books at a time. And say, I can write more than one book, actually, at a time, but I can't read more than one book at a time. So I very much have to... I can't read without a biro in my hand. I have to be taking notes constantly, whether or not I'm reviewing the book at, that I'm reading. I review 60 or 70 books a year, I'd have thought, so over, more than one a week. I suppose my number one hobby, really.
Where do you read, and how long at one time?
I read down in the room next to the kitchen. So I have my kids and my wife wander backwards and forwards, but they are very kind when I'm in a book and don't disturb me. And I can't really find, I don't find it easy to read for longer than about an hour and a half in sort of one sitting. I feel I have to sort of get up and wander around and do something else after that time.
You've pointed out that, for instance, that Winston Churchill wrote 37 books, that Napoleon had 33,000 letters. As you, and then all the letters that you got and the documents from the King George Georgian Project, how much of that do you read?
Well, as much as possible, you know. If you've got 4 years, and by the way, Disraeli is the same. Disraeli, there are 10 big published volumes of his correspondence, and that only takes you up to 1868 when he became Prime Minister for the first time. Now you have to do it. But what I don't believe in is using research assistants to read for you, because I find that, first of all, it's the fun bit is the research. That's the thing I enjoy most about being a writer. And secondly, you can't truly trust that they aren't going to cut corners and basically plagiarize. And if you then put this into your book, you'd be a plagiarist, which is the quickest way to destroy your reputation as a historian. And thirdly, you know, actually, you often wind up having to put more work into work that research assistants do. I've had lots of friends who are authors who reckon that it doesn't really save you that much time anyway. So I've never used a research assistant, and I never would.
Okay, how do you remember everything that you remember? And I'll give you an example. When you watch you talk to an audience, right off the top of your head, you'll say things like, in the Revolutionary War, there were 26 major battles. The Brits won 15. The United States won 8. There were 3 draws or whatever it is. Or you'll be quoting a battle that Napoleon was involved in and rattle off the fact that he won 60 battles but never won at sea, and then name the number of ships that he had versus the number that the Brits had. How do you remember all that? What do you have a technique, or is it just your vast brain?
That's a very nice way of putting it, Brian. Thank you very much indeed. But I find that people do tend to know things that they're fascinated by and that they love and that they're interested in, don't they? I bet there are any number of statistics and quotations about something that you are expert in or you love that you could rattle off as well. It's just a question, I think, of being committed, really.
On the George III book, you told one audience that you set your computer on a Google alert for the name George III, and a day never passes that you don't see some negative story coming out of the United States. Explain that one.
Yeah, it's quite a fun thing, Google alerts. You type in the name, and you every single time the name crops up in any newspaper or website, you get to see it. And there isn't a day, as you say, that doesn't pass. In fact, I got a George III Google alert today, and there was, I think there were 3 articles in American newspapers saying that he was a tyrant and a monster, and somebody called him a dictator, you know. This is a man who never arrested an American editor, never closed an American newspaper, never put troops on any American city before the revolution, apart from Boston in 1768. He just didn't act like a tyrant. He didn't try and stop the Stamp Act Congress from meeting, or the Continental Congress. You know, you'd have never got away with that under Catherine the Great or any of his Russian or Prussian or Austrian or French or Spanish counterparts of the day.
I saw you speak to a significant number of places online, and most of them, Heritage, Hoover, Hudson, Hillsdale College, Pepperdine, Bradley Foundation, even Scaramucci, the Mooch, as he's called, the New York Historical Society, Prager University, U.S. Army War College, most of them, and if I'm overcharacterizing, tell me, are conservative institutions. Is that, did the liberal institutions in America invite you to speak?
I don't think you can call the New York Historical Society a political institution at all. And there was another one that you mentioned there, which I don't recognize as being conservative.
Well, Politics and Prose had you, and they normally have liberal books that they feature. Folger Library had you.
And I've been on various left-wing radio shows and things. A lot on NPR and everything. I'm perfectly happy to talk to anybody who will allow me to proselytize about the books I write and the work that I do. You know, it's just so please, you know, if you know of any liberal or left-wing outlets, put them in touch. You know, I've been on CNN as well. I've been on I don't think I've ever sort of skewed my output politically. I just think that they're the people who've asked me.
I've not heard you skew it politically, but I have seen quotes that you say you're a right winger. Is that accurate? And explain it, what it means for you.
No, I'm on the I'm on the right wing of the Conservative Party in that I'm a Thatcherite. I'm a supporter, was at least when she was alive, of the views of Margaret Thatcher. I've never been any further to the right than that. And of course, you have to remember that to be right wing in Britain is nothing like being right wing in America, where you conservatives who are way to the right of people like me.
What's the difference between it being a right winger in Britain and in the United States?
Oh, I don't know. You seem to be very much more socially conservative in the States. You know, we don't have in Britain, just to take one example, we don't have a debate over abortion. It's just not an issue here in England, whereas, of course, it is a very important one over the EU.
One other thing about the audience is, and because I am one, I might be able to get away with asking this question. Most of your audiences, I see a lot of white-haired, older men versus, you know, a diverse audience. Is that your experience in the United States? And if it is, why?
Yes, I think that's probably fair. I think probably because it's retirees who have the time on their hands, and maybe also the money to attend these literary festivals and to, you know, spend the time necessary listening to historians like me. I think younger people, I'm thinking now in terms of my kids, tend to get their intellectual stimulation from podcasts and so on. Whereas actually the people who literally turn up and then get in a line and buy a book tend to be of an older generation.
What do you think the future of your kind of history is then?
Well, do you mean my kind of history, the narrative, sort of comprehensive history? Or
yes.
Do you mean
something else? Serious, yeah. Narrative, large books?
I think it's getting smaller and smaller. I know it's getting smaller and smaller. I think the book sales, individual book sales, are still pretty strong, but the number of people who find that they can earn a living from it has shrunk. And I see an awful, much, much smaller amount of space being given to books in newspapers and so on. Which is why the podcast is so important, is why what you're doing is, in fact, I'm setting up my own podcast next week, is I think it's taking over essentially from book reviews, because people still have the hunger to know about the past. They're still fascinated by history. It's just that they are now, you know, getting the information about books in a different way than before.
What is your podcast going to be about?
It's going to be called The Secrets of Statesmanship. It's a Hoover Institution podcast. It's going to be, I'm going to be interviewing various statesmen about the importance of history in their lives, how they were taught history, what they've learned from history, and so on. And also I'm going to be talking to historians about their subjects and about what the people they've written about assumed from history and learned from history.
Where can people find it?
Not the first idea. It's coming out next week, and I ought to know that. Of course I ought to. But thank you for putting me on the spot there, Brian.
I assume, once again, we can Google it and find it?
Uncle Google, he's the answer.
Another thing that I noticed in your – are you aware that you have so many YouTube and C-SPAN talks available? Have you ever gotten online and looked?
No, no. Someone told me this the other day, that there was one debate I did with Adam Zamoyski, who's a charming and rather brilliant historian, Polish historian. And somebody said that 500,000 people had watched this debate, which is the most extraordinary thing, you know. I mean, one sort of shudders to think, you know, 500,000 people. I don't know whether or not it's reflected any of this in terms of book sales, which obviously is an important aspect of it all. But it must be, ultimately, I'd have thought.
Which of all your books sold the most?
Churchill. Churchill. That sold over 500,000 copies in 18 languages.
And how is George III doing?
Incredibly well. Yeah, I haven't got the numbers to hand, but it's and it's not as big as Churchill, but it's actually an awful lot better than the publishers were thinking, and it's got a post-Christmas sale, which is the important thing. Sometimes after Christmas, a book will just collapse in terms of sales, but that hasn't happened to George III. So I'm very pleased to see that, therefore, there are an awful lot of your countrymen who recognize that, that yes, of course, you need wartime propaganda in a revolution. And as I say, the 1770s were the right time for America to become independent. You had 2.5 million population. You had burgeoning year-on-year growth. You had more bookshops in Philadelphia than in any other city of the empire, except for London. And so, you know, it was ready for independence. It just wasn't fought against a king who was in any sense a tyrant.
Quoting you, you said that in a recent poll, and I don't know how long ago this particular talk was, that 20% of British teenagers think that Winston Churchill was a fictional character.
Yeah, terrifying, terrifying. And in the same poll, some equal kind of number thought that the American War of Independence had been won by Denzel Washington. The ignorance out there is terrifying, and it only seems to be growing. And so, you know, when people do buy books and read them, they are doing a service to civilization, in my view. Just learning anything about the truth and the past. But equally, in that same extraordinary survey, and it was a big survey. It was thousands of teenage schoolchildren, so it wasn't just one of those sort of one-off thing with no proper structure. They also, 47% of them believed that Sherlock Holmes was a real person, and 53% thought that Eleanor Rigby was a real person.
I have to say that the folks that are in the control room with me at the moment, when you talked about Denzel Washington, they both lost it, and we almost had an on-air catastrophe here. I'm looking at the day we're recording this is the day that Jeff Zucker stepped down from CNN because of a romantic affair that he had been having with one of his colleagues. And I only mention that because you wrote a column, and I'd never seen this before. I should have in history. You wrote a column for the Daily Mail last Sunday, in which you were, you can pick the words, but defending Boris Johnson and what he has been doing over there in the party and all isn't nearly as bad or as wrong as you go through a lot of people, including Neville Chamberlain, Clement Attlee, Anthony Eden, the things that they got involved in, plus David Lloyd George. And I'm going to stop there before I ask you another question on this list, and that is, you have a shirt in your home that belonged to David Lloyd George. Why?
Yes, I'm looking at it now, in fact. And my wife, who thinks I collect historical artifacts. I've got quite a large collection. And my wife calls it bric-a-brac. And she wanted to have this shirt of David Lloyd George washed. I said, absolutely no way. It's got the DNA of the great man there. And he had his stiff collars. I've got a couple of his stiff collars with his initials embossed on them. It's I don't know why is the answer. It's obviously a form of psychological disorder to need to be surrounded by artifacts of the people that you write about. I've got Winston Churchill's bow tie and a pair of his slippers. So a lock of Napoleon's hair and so on. I'm looking around my study at the moment, a cannonball from the Battle of Waterloo.
Given what we're just talking about people not knowing things, I better ask you who David Lloyd George was and why that's important enough to he was important enough oh, to have a shirt.
He was the Prime Minister who won the First World War.
In addition, you have the Iron Curtain speech on your wall, I believe, from Winston Churchill. Why do you have that? And tell us if it's the actual speech, and if it's not, why is it important?
No, it's not the speech. It's an invitation to the speech, and also it's the program of Westminster College, and the speech that was taking place in the auditorium on the 5th of March, 1946. It's such an important speech, isn't it? It's the one way Winston Churchill essentially wakes up the West, shakes the West awake to recognize that Stalin, for all the extraordinary things he did in defeating Hitler, was not Uncle Joe, was not a sort of friendly and benign force that he'd been made out to be quite a lot by the media during the Second World War, but was actually a true tyrant.
In this article that I was talking about in the Daily Mail last Sunday, the thing that got my attention, I just didn't know this, I'll read it out loud. You're talking about things that other prime ministers have done that were far more important than the problem that Boris Johnson has. You said John Major had sex with his colleague Edwina Curry on the cabinet table. Tony Blair took one million pound donation from motor racing tycoon Bernie Ecclestone just prior to changing the rules on tobacco advertising in the sport. The point is that story on Edwina Curry and John Major, how big a deal was that one that came out? And that was, what was it, in the 80s?
Well, it didn't come out in the 90s. It didn't come out until after John Major had given up the premiership in 1997, or at least been voted out of the premiership in 1997. So in a sense, that's a much more... there are other things that he did that were arguably much worse in my case. In my sense, is the deal he did at Maastricht, where he agreed to an ever closer union with the EU, the European Union, at a time when virtually none of his party and a lot of Britons didn't want that. But yes, there are things that an awful lot of people have done, in my view at least, much worse than Boris Johnson.
One of the reasons that I got into this, I mentioned Jeff Zucker, is the attention. You want to pause for a minute?
No, do go on.
Okay. One of the reasons that I mentioned Jeff Zucker because of the reason he stepped down was because of...
I haven't heard of Jeff Zucker, I'm afraid, so I'm not going to be able to make any comment particularly.
No, you don't have to.
I don't know who he is.
He's the president of CNN. And we've been going through a lot of this, as you know, over here. You're no stranger to it in Great Britain. But I'm looking...
And he was having an affair with one of his own employees, was he?
Yes, for, I gather, a number of years. Anyway... the reason why I started down this road is I'm looking at a reminder on one of my notes about Pamela Harriman's letters. And I heard you talking about these letters, and I have a couple questions. One, what were they, and why were they so interesting? And why would we know, why would she have saved those letters? Or how do those kind of things end up in archives?
Well, these letters in particular are not in an archive. They are in the private possession of the Churchill family. And so I was very lucky to be allowed to read them. They're love letters, essentially, from her various lovers. And she had a good number of them, actually, during the Second World War. And lots of them are not just about love. They also, you know, talk about how various people are going off to Yalta, and they mention her father-in-law, Winston Churchill. So they were of relevance. They had never been quoted in a book before, so I was very fortunate to be able to have a chance to read them. I mean, there are about 40 or 45 or so archives that I was able to use for my Churchill book that had never been used for any book before.
You do talk about the fact you're getting access early on to a number of things like the Georgian papers and also Winston Churchill's things, the Queen's father's diaries, the current Queen's father's diaries. How does this work? Do you ask for them, or do they call you up and say, Andrew, we're ready. We're going to dump these in your lap?
No, you ask for them, and you keep asking for them, and you ask for them ad nauseam. And finally, a decision is made that's different from all of the earlier ones. Why they, after 75 years, allowed me to look at the King's diaries from the Second World War, I don't know. But I was tremendously lucky that they did, of course. I think that after 75 years, you know, most of the people are dead, of course, who said the things and mentioned in the diaries and did the things. So there's very much a sense that no one's going to get embarrassed. And so why not allow the public to know what was going through the mind of the head of state during the Second World War?
Is there anything about Disraeli that we don't know that you're going to get access to?
If there were, I wouldn't tell you, I'm afraid, Brian, because I haven't signed the contract. I haven't started writing the book. I haven't. There are other people who are writing about Disraeli, and I'd be insane, frankly insane, to tell you any scoops that I think.
Come on, Andrew.
Will you forgive me? Will you forgive me?
Yes,
please,
I will.
Forgive me, Brian. No, actually, I mean, it's very ignoble in a sense, because your first thought when you come across papers that hadn't been spotted. I felt this very strongly when I was in Churchill Archives in Cambridge, and I discovered a series of hieroglyphics and shorthand noting, and I realised that they were the verbatim accounts of the War Cabinet, and that they'd been stuck in a box for 73 years, and nobody had. And nobody had looked into it, and nobody had checked out what they were, because they were almost impossible to decipher. And my first feeling was, oh gosh, I hope nobody else finds these before I publish my book, which is a pretty ignoble initial reaction to have, I accept.
It's time to let you go, but before we do, what advice would you have for somebody listening to this that's considerably younger and thinks they want to get into history? And they're, you know, they look at what you've done, and it's rather substantial, and they say, how do I do that? What advice would you have for them?
Well, obviously, do work hard at history at school and university. You know, it's a wonderful opportunity to use libraries and to interrogate teachers and to get the qualifications needed. The next thing I'd say is don't expect to become very rich. It's a profession where there are an awful lot of people who earn barely above the minimum wage, frankly. I would say that it is grindingly hard work if it's done properly. And if you're not willing to put in the grinding hard work, then don't do it, because there are an awful lot of good historians out there who will. And finally, I would say, if I haven't put you off by any of those earlier things, then it really is the best job in the world. It's totally wonderful to be able to follow something that fascinates you every day of your life.
Andrew Roberts, how much time did you spend in the United States on your tour? And how much time do you spend at home as you're doing your research?
I tend to spend most of the time in archives when I'm doing my research, but I write the books at home. I spent 6 weeks on a book tour in America in November and December, where I spoke, I think, 40 times. And I'm coming back to America at the end of this month to speak at the Museum of the American Revolution in Philadelphia and at Mount Vernon and a few places in New York. So all in all, it's a tremendous fun aspect of being a historian, the publicizing bit, but it's not the most fun. The most fun is actually being in the archives and researching.
Our guest has been Andrew Roberts, a British historian, wrote over 19 books. Three of the biggest are the one on Napoleon, the one on Winston Churchill, and the current book, The Last King of America, The Misunderstood Reign of George III. We thank you, sir, very much for your time.
Thanks for listening. Please rate, review, and subscribe to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. We would love to hear from you. You can email us at podcasts@c-span.org.